Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, June 12th, 2024, we're delighted to host a courthouse steps decision on Thornell versus Jones, which was decided recently by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts, and this program as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I'll keep my introduction to our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more, you can access his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Robert McBride, who is partner in charge of the Kentucky office of Tenius & Hollister, LLP. Prior to his time there, Bob was an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Kentucky for over 15 years. As an AUSA, he first chaired criminal jury trials in the U.S. District Court and handled appeals before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Additionally, he was the district's national security prosecutor and the Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council coordinator. During his tenure as an AUSA, Bob also held several leadership positions, serving as manager of the London Branch Office, criminal chief, and a supervisor of the Fort Mitchell Branch Office. Bob also formerly served in the United States Navy's Judge Advocate General Corps for over 10 years, and I leave it there. A last note, and then I'll hand it over for a set of opening remarks to our audience. If you have questions throughout the program, please submit them by the question and answer feature, as we'll have an extended portion of this webinar available to answer those. With that, however, I'll hand it over. Bob, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kayla. I always appreciate your very kind introduction. So today we're going to talk about Thornell versus Jones that came out. The opinion was issued on May 30th, 2024. In very general terms, the case involves a restatement of the standards for determining ineffective assistance of counsel under the Strickland standard. I'm going to talk about sort of a brief overview of the law of IAC, how those cases generally come to fruition procedurally. Then I'll talk about the quick procedural history of this case, and finally about the court's decision. So let me start with an overview of the law, and it's rather fundamental. So the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution provides every defendant with the right to have assistance of counsel for his defense. This right applies at all levels of the criminal proceedings at which the fair trial may be jeopardized. Consistent with this, the Supreme Court has held that the representation has to be effective. So ineffective assistance of counsel then violates the Sixth Amendment. The issue becomes, or was, what constitutes ineffective representation. That issue was out there because prior to this Strickland case that was issued in 1984, ineffective or effective assistance of counsel cases were handled on a case-by-case basis, but over time, courts tended to find an objective standard. So in Strickland versus Washington, 4466 U.S. 668, issued in 1984, the court provided us with a test. And the test is this: under counsel's representation, it must not fall below an objective standard of reasonableness. And to determine that, there is a two-pronged test. First, was the representation unreasonable under the prevailing practice? This sort of makes sense. There are different practices in state courts than federal courts. There are different practices across time. Second, was there a reasonable probability that the outcome of the proceedings would have been different had the lawyer's representation been effective? So this objective test had a lot of litigation because there's arguments that some of these terms determining the objectivity based on the circumstances are easily litigated. So this case comes up on a habeas petition, initially under 28 U.S.C. 2254. How these cases happen are you'll have a sentence or a determination of a guilty plea, usually with a plea agreement. So as a practice note, it's interesting that most state bars do not permit a plea agreement where the defendant waives his right to collaterally attack a guilty plea, sentence, or conviction through his habeas petition, which is a collateral attack. So if you're entering a guilty plea, you can have a waiver of the substantive waiver of the conviction, guilty plea, and sentence, but you can't waive the collateral right to do that. So let me make some distinctions here about the substantive and the collateral right. So the collateral right comes up after there is a conviction. In some cases, it's not ripe until the case goes up to the Court of Appeals on the substantive claims or even the Supreme Court. And generally, the petitioner has 1 year after the final resolution of the substantive issues, for lack of a better term. The habeas petition, and there are two statutes here, 28 U.S.C. 2254, and in federal court, federal defendants use 28 U.S.C. 2255. The prisoner, either a person who is serving a sentence or is going to serve a sentence, very shortly may file the petition. But almost universally, it's somebody who is already incarcerated on a sentence. So they can bring this civil collateral attack as a habeas petition to challenge what is essentially ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, you might imagine that this term, ineffective assistance of counsel, allows for a lot of creativity for prisoners to challenge their conviction, sentence, or judgment based on things his lawyer did or not do, did or did not do. Anybody who has practiced criminal law, particularly at the trial court level, knows that once a defendant gets into jail, they may read something like busted by the feds or talk to their other fellow incarcerates, many of whom have already been through the system a couple of times. And all of a sudden, your defendant decides that you have represented him ineffectively. And that ultimately, everybody in jail believes themselves to be innocent. So the habeas petition is a way for the courts to officially address these issues. In general, the habeas petitions have to be filed after 1 year of the final determination of the substantive issues, whether the district court, court of appeals, the Supreme Court. For a state case, it can go all the way through the state trial court, state court of appeals, state Supreme Court, and then kicked over to the U.S. District Court, and finally, Court of Appeals, and up to the Supreme Court. So as you can imagine, some of these claims take a long time to adjudicate. The government tries to make it easy for petitioners to file. They file with their court, their trial level court. There are actually forms in the rules, in the rule book, and most prisons have the petitions on the computers and available to the defendants. There are rules the defendant has to follow in presenting his petition, but as a practical matter, even if they don't follow the rules as to completeness and substance, courts are going to take them up anyways. And then what happens when a district court or a trial level court receives the petition? There is a hearing. It puts the prosecutor and the defense counsel in an unusual circumstance. And the defense counsel is actually represented by the prosecutor in most cases, who defends the work of the defense lawyer. In other words, the prosecutor is going to present evidence, sometimes the testimony of the defense lawyer, him or herself, to try to defeat the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. At these hearings, you can introduce evidence and witnesses, sometimes the defense lawyer will testify. Very often, the defense lawyer submits an affidavit, and sometimes that's enough. The lesson for defense lawyers, though, is document your file. So I've seen some of these cases go off the rails when the attorney has not adequately documented his or her file as to what they did, what they advised, and so on. All right. So let's get to this case. This case took about 32 years to get the Supreme Court through the habeas petition process. So it involves actually a triple murder. In 1992, a fellow named Danny Lee Jones was day drinking with his buddy Robert Weaver at Robert's home. Jones knew that Weaver had a gun collection. And for whatever reason, Jones decided he wanted that gun collection. The first step in getting the gun collection was to beat Robert over the head with a baseball bat, rendering Robert unconscious. He goes into the house and he finds Robert's grandmother, a woman named Catherine Gumenia, sitting in a living room watching TV. He hits grandma with a baseball bat hard enough to crack her skull. He leaves her lying there on the living room floor. While all this is going on, Robert's 7-year-old daughter is in the house and she sees the grandmother assaulted with a baseball bat. So she does what every kid would do. She runs under her parents' bed. Jones comes into the room, drags her out under the bed, and hits her with the baseball bat, causing a gash on her left face from her ear to her jaw. And instead of finishing her off with a baseball bat, he decides to smother her with a pillow, killing her. Jones gets the guns and goes to load them in Catherine's car, grandmother's car. And while he does that, Robert wakes up and Robert tries to run away. Jones catches him and hits him with a baseball bat. He finally gets him into the garage and kills Robert with a baseball bat while Robert's on his knees inside the garage. The grandmother remains in a coma when Jones is charged by the state of Arizona with 2 counts of first-degree murder, Robert and his daughter, Tisha, and 1 count of attempted first-degree murder. Oh, by the way, what Jones did was he took the guns, sold them for $2,000, and went and had himself a little bit of a vacation in Las Vegas. When the first responders showed up, as I mentioned, the grandmother was still alive and was in a coma. So when the state charged Jones, that's why it was 2 counts of first degree murder and 1 attempted first degree murder, even though after the charging of the case, the grandmother died. At a jury trial, Jones was convicted at all counts and the Arizona trial court imposed the death sentence. Now, Arizona's law, and if there's any experts on there, please jump in and help me. When the judge is determining the sentencing for a death penalty case, there are enumerated aggravating factors and enumerating mitigating factors that the court must consider based on the evidence at trial and at the sentencing hearing. So in this case, the court found that the aggravating factors was that Jones committed multiple homicides during the commission of this offense, that Jones was motivated by pecuniary gain, the $2,000 to go to Las Vegas. The murders were especially, and this is the statutory language, especially heinous, cruel, or deprived. I think that was meant by the way he committed the murders. And finally, that the victim, 7-year-old Tisha, was a child. There was evidence provided by the defense lawyer, and this is sort of classic mitigation evidence. all of which are enumerated under Arizona law. One, that Jones suffered from long-term substance and alcohol abuse since the age of 13. I think the testimony was that his grandfather introduced him to alcohol and drugs at the age of 13. Second, that the incident may have been caused by a genetic predisposition to alcohol and head trauma he has received from abuse as a child. And that at the time of Jones' crime, he was under the influence of alcohol and or drugs. All of that evidence was supported both by the pre-sentence report and the sentencing hearing. So the PSR found Jones was abused as a trial, began using drugs and alcohol at 13, had brain trauma repeatedly through the ages of 9 and 19, had received psychiatric treatment as a child, and then both his father and his stepfather had physically abused him. Counsel, which I think is particularly important here, provided testimony from a forensic psychologist, and he testified that Jones was reared in a chaotic, in his words, grisly and violent situation that was home where it was prevalent with physical abuse. He confirmed that he had serious head trauma that potentially contributed to the act. He had diagnosed Jones with bipolar affective disorder and ADHD, and that Jones was predisposed to substance abuse, and importantly, that he would not have committed the murders had he not been intoxicated at the time. And finally, that Jones showed some remorse. So the Arizona court found, according to its statutes, that the mitigating factors were not sufficiently substantial to outweigh the aggravating sentences. And as a result, was required to sentence Jones to death. Jones appealed the conviction, went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which upheld the convictions. Then Jones sought relief on the theory of that his defense counsel was ineffective. Here's what Jones claimed at the trial court level when it reheard the 2255 issue. First, that his lawyer should have retained a neuropsychologist instead of a forensic psychologist. And second, that his lawyer failed to timely request a neurological or neurophysical testing. So the first element one could see might be very close to having a forensic psychologist testify. The second obviously comes from his theory that he should have had a neuropsychologist because a neuropsychologist would have required more time for testing, according to him. State court, trial court denied the petition. It went through the appellate court and up to the Arizona Supreme Court, and which upheld the district court's determination that there was not ineffective assistance of counsel. One note that I missed is that the district court in Arizona, when considering the IAC claim, looked at the testimony that was presented both at the original hearing and that was augmented, and found that it didn't move the needle with regard to the balance between the mitigating evidence and the aggravating evidence. After the Arizona Supreme Court, our friend Jones goes up to the district court, federal district court. Federal district court agreed with the Arizona Supreme Court, the Arizona Court of Appeals, and the Arizona trial court, finding that the aggravating factors based on the evidence outweighed the mitigating factors. Jones then went to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit granted relief The Supreme Court then vacated that determination by the Ninth Court, instructing it whether it was proper, whether it was proper to consider the new evidence under Collin versus Pinholster, 563 U.S. 170. The Ninth Circuit again granted relief, holding it was permissible to consider the new evidence, and importantly, that there was a reasonable probability that Jones would not have gotten the death penalty if that evidence was presented at trial. The government asked for an en banc review, which was denied. But among the dissenters for the denial of the en banc review, Judge Bennett commented, and I note this because it's important, that the panel flouted Strickland by crediting questionable, weak, and cumulative mitigation as enough to overcome the weighty, aggravating circumstances. I point that out because it comes back in the decision of the Supreme Court, which the state of Arizona took it to. So the Supreme Court's decision was written by Justice Alito, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justices Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justice Kagan, dissented, but they agreed with the decision of the majority court. And I'll talk about that briefly, what their dissent was. And Justice Jackson dissented in whole with the decision of the majority. So a couple of key points. First, from the Supreme Court. First, they found that Judge Bennett had said that the Ninth Circuit had inadequately taken into account the aggravating circumstance in this case. Second, it noted that the Ninth Circuit had a strange rule that prohibited from evaluating the relative strength of expert witnesses in a habeas case. On that point, the Supreme Court said essentially, that's a completely unsound rule. And then in habeas cases, it's of the essence to evaluate the relative strengths of the aggravating and the mitigating evidence in this particular case. They also found that, thirdly, that the Ninth Circuit had attached persuasive value to Jones' mental health conditions, even where there was no link between the mental health conditions and the execution of the victims in this case. In other words, there was nothing about them that triggered this event or caused him to carry through in such a violent way. The SCOTUS sort of admonished the Ninth Circuit because the Ninth Circuit in relying on the mental health conditions, argued that under Eddings versus Oklahoma, essentially a sentencer cannot refuse to consider the relevant mitigating evidence. But it took it a logical step beyond that, and essentially use that theory to find that the mitigating evidence could not be unpersuasive. And what the Supreme Court said was, no, what it means is you have to consider the mitigating evidence. That does not mean that you can find mitigating evidence unpersuasive, as all the prior courts have done. The court believed that the Ninth's evaluation was fundamentally at odds with the standards set out under Strickland to determine ineffective assistance of counsel. The court looked at the factors, which is one of the reasons for Justice Sotomayor's dissent, and found, if you're looking at the district court's decision, that the mental health evidence didn't move the needle at all because there was no causal connection between that and the act, that evaluation doesn't change the balance. The PTSD findings of the experts, new and old, and ADH findings, had they been linked by the evidence, court did say that would have been a significant mitigating factor, but that evidence simply didn't apply in this case. As for the mental health impairments, despite there's some issues that there, the defendant's IQ was essentially average. He knew what he was doing. Jones had also introduced new evidence that his grandfather, who introduced him to drugs and alcohol, had sexually abused him. The problem with this new evidence that seemed to have been overlooked by the night was that the parents' testimony contradicted this. The parents at the sentencing hearing said, or below, said, look, grandfather did introduce him to the alcohol, but there is no evidence to indicate to us. We had no experience in which the grandfather was sexually abusing Jones. In addition, some of the new evidence that Jones wanted the court to consider was that his stepfather had sexually abused him. The original evidence was that he had physically abused him. I think you saw or recall in the PSR between 9 and 19, he had been physically assaulted. Well, that was supposedly by his stepfather, Randy. The new allegation was a physical abuse. Interestingly, the Supreme Court noted that Arizona courts don't give a lot of weight to this kind of mitigation evidence where it's not substantiated and not contemporaneous. The same thing goes for the new allegation of physical abuse by Randy. This new allegation, Randy was very strict and verbally hostile down at the trial court. That was the testimony here. The new allegation was that he was physically abusive. I apologize for that mistake. With regard to this new kind of evidence, again, unsubstantiated and countered by prior testimony, the courts of Arizona, their case law indicates that they don't really see that as a significant factor to mitigating to move the needle here. One comment I want to make here is that, you know, when you're looking at a Strickland analysis for ineffective assistance of counsel, every trial court will tell a defendant that's a high bar to reach. And the reason it's a high bar to reach is because under Strickland, as long as a defense lawyer provides classic mitigation, mental health, drug abuse, physical abuse, immaturity, mitigating circumstances around the case, which we don't really have here, factual mitigation, then generally a defense lawyer has met its effective representation. In fact, Strickland's really most effective where none of this classic mitigation evidence has been presented. So such complete lack of mitigation where it exists, classic mitigation is generally constitutionally insufficient. So based on its analysis, the Supreme Court upheld the denial of the U.S. District Court's denial of the habeas. There were two dissents, as I mentioned. The first one from Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justice Kagan. Now, while they agreed in the decision, the criticism of the majority was that they went too far into evaluating the facts of the case themselves. And I think there is some legitimacy at some level of that determination in general, of that decision in general, or that position in general. But in a case like this, where it's so factually determinative because of the way in which the Arizona law construes the mechanism for coming to or against the imposition of a death penalty. I think the majority really had no choice in this circumstance. But I do see, as a general matter, Justice Kagan's dissent and why they dissented, joined by Justice Kagan. Justice Jackson simply did not agree with the decision of the court and felt that the Ninth Circuit had followed all of the precepts of Strickland by, you know, looking at the evidence, evaluating the evidence, and finding that there was a reasonable probability that had the defense counsel provided the additional new evidence and brought in a neuropsychologist, that Mr. Jones would not have gotten the death penalty. So in sum, the Supreme Court really reiterated the application of Strickland to the Ninth Circuit and all circuit courts below and district courts. The two dissents were, I don't think Justice Jackson's dissent was overly persuasive, at least not to me. And I understand Justice Sotomayor's dissent in the basis for it, of course, joined by Justice Kagan. All right, Kayla, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. That was a really helpful summary of the case, the opinions, how we got here. As you mentioned, it's a decades-long history, and that was an effective 30 minutes to get us all up to speed. I will indicate to our audience, we can now take questions. If you have those, please feel free to send them in. In the meantime, I have a couple of my own that I'd love to pose. I always love moderating these because then I get to ask the questions. You, starting where you left off, Justice Jackson's dissent argues that the record and factors were suitably considered and raises the fact that relief has been granted by SCOTUS in what she argues are similar cases, while the majority argues that the Arizona Supreme Court has notably not granted habeas relief in cases with even lesser aggravating factors. Under the Strickland framework, is there clarity as to which court's precedent matters for relevance concerning the likelihood of a different outcome? Is that something that usually comes up? How do those precedents and sort of court perspectives affect the way that this is understood?
Well, the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court of the land. So I think in the opinion, in the majority opinion, what the court was trying to illustrate was how these factors under Arizona law are evaluated, to give a normative understanding of how it works, even in murder cases. I think what was most compelling to me was, and maybe it's just my practice history, that they had never found mitigating factors overwhelming when there's a contemporary or at the same time double murder. And, you know, if you look at some of the factors that the Arizona court cited, the heinousness of the murders, the child victim, the way Jones went back and finished off Roberts, the fact that it was an invasion of a private house for a fairly minimal amount of value of the guns, I think it's really hard to get away from the aggravating factors overruling the mitigating factors in the Arizona context. The mitigation that was presented by the defense lawyer was classic mitigation. And very often in cases like this, there just isn't too much. It's not like there's evidence that Robert started a fight with him and he was defending himself. It's not as though, you know, he was, in a fugue state where he didn't understand what he was doing and why he was doing. So I think those cases were really to give a flavor of what has happened below in the Arizona Supreme Court, more than relying on, as precedent that they're following.
Got it. Thank you. Moving to Jones's interpretation of Strickland, he seemed to put forward a fairly novel understanding of what was required in order for there to be a need to administer relief, in contending that if there was substantial evidence of a kind that a reasonable sentencer might deem relevant to the defendant's moral culpability, if that kind of evidence had not been presented, then that was enough and he should get habeas relief. Was that argument granted at any level?
No. The moral evidence, first, I would say, what moral evidence? I don't know what moral justification there would be for murdering somebody over $2,000 worth of guns. I mean, you know, that's probably, it's a practical matter, that's probably a collection of junk, given how expensive firearms actually are. And it avoids the actually properly established standard by Strickland, which is there evidence which has a reasonable probability of changing the outcome of, in this case, the trial, the sentence. And while I can see in some instances where, you know, this morality theory is something that could be introduced as motive or sort of an equitable argument, I think it skirts Strickland and was inviting, you know, a change in Strickland and those standards.
Got it. Thanks. As you mentioned, sort of Justice Sotomayor's dissent, which Justice Kagan joined, agrees that the Ninth Circuit is in error. And then they just suggest that the appropriate remedy is to remand for reconsideration based on the full record. You talked a little bit about this, given that Arizona is a bit unique. But since the court had already sent this back once, why not just remand again? And does the fact that the case had already come up and already been sent back to the Ninth Circuit once affect whether or not it'd be appropriate to remand in such a way?
Well, I am not very good at understanding the motives of the Supreme Court. But were I sitting on that bench, I probably would have had enough. This, from my view, this case is overwhelmingly in favor of the aggravating factors, and that whatever was introduced subsequently did not move the needle in mitigation. I think in death penalty cases, people permit courts, judges, lawyers permit as much flexibility in the rules as they can. And the Ninth had already made the same decision essentially twice. And it seemed as though it might have been futile to send it back to the Ninth again. You know, and on the record, full record, well, presumably the court had looked at the full record too.
Got it. Thanks. Looking again at sort of the interestingness of the way that Justice Sotomayor's dissent is a dissent and also kind of agrees, given the way that the dissents were argued, although it's technically a 6-3 split, how should the actual arguments affect the way we think about how the court is actually split on this issue?
Well, I think that Justice Sotomayor looks at the case, if I'm reading her mind, I think she's looking at this case and saying, okay, you know, Strickland factors, we could have just determined it on the Strickland factors and, you know, looking at the Arizona court's evidence and finding no reason that there's a substantial flaw there, instead of getting into the further evaluation of the evidence, perhaps even talking about the Arizona cases you noted. I feel that Justice Sotomayor's opinion is really about how far should the Supreme Court really be evaluating or re-evaluating evidence in cases. As I said before, I think there's some legitimacy to that point of view. Although in this type of case, I think that it lends itself more to an evaluation of the facts than might be usual.
Got it. That's useful in sort of thinking through the actual split. Other than the impact for the parties in the case itself, what, if anything, could be the immediate impact of this decision? And are there any other cases that might be affected by this ruling? It might be too narrow for there to be a larger impact.
No, I can. I I think the impact will be more systemic. You know, there's a lot of litigation over these 2255 cases, if you'll let me use the shorthand. And it's understandable because people are in prison. That's the general fact pattern. But courts can be overwhelmed with this kind of litigation. The same issues are raised over and over again. And I think what this case does is provide us with clearer vision of how the court wants the stricter Strickland standards apply. You'll forget that. I'll give you an example. Some of the courts in this area are requiring defense counsel to provide a notice 14 days after the notice of appeal runs, stating that they had consulted with their client and that they're contemporaneous with the notice period for the appeal, and that your client does not want to file a notice of appeal. You file that notice in the event that you did not file a notice of appeal. So you have 14 days to file a notice of appeal. You've got to assert to the court that you consulted with your defendant, your client, that he or she did not want to file a notice of appeal. And the reason for that is one of the routine complaints on 2255s is my lawyer didn't tell me I had a right to appeal, or I told my lawyer to appeal and he didn't. So it kind of obviates or makes more difficult for the defendant to raise that issue. It also makes sure the defense lawyer goes back and talks to his client and say, hey, have you changed your mind? You really want to file a notice of appeal? You haven't filed. We haven't talked about it. What have you? So I'm not averse to that practice, but I think the Strickland standards, when properly interpreted, can reduce some of routine litigation that often goes nowhere.
Got it. That's interesting and useful to think about as sort of an impact of the decision beyond just for the parties in the case. Now that we have the decision, and this will be my second to last question, are there any questions that remain open in this area of Strickland review?
Well, none that I see, but there will be continued litigation on this issue because lawyers are creative and defense lawyers are creative, and there'll be lots of litigation on this. Whether it reaches the Supreme Court at any time soon, I don't know. But, you know, the problem with the standards are, you know, is it reasonable under the current norms of practice? Well, that varies across the nation. It varies across the tribunals. It varies across the type of case. So there's some flexibility there to making that argument. And then the reasonable probability standard, like any totality of the circumstances standard, is subject to litigation. So is it going to quell litigation? No. Will it crystallize the standard a little more? Probably.
Got it. And any last comments, thoughts, concluding remarks you'd like to give?
No, I think you've let me ramble enough.
Not at all. We really appreciate you joining us and taking the time. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.